My next guest needs absolutely no introduction. He's an absolute Aussie legend. He's done so many things, there's no doubt not enough time in our quick chat to cover it all. But the reason to talk to him is he's just released an autobiography. His name is Dick Smith, and the book is called My Adventurous Life. It's a great honour to have him on the line. Mr. Smith, how are you, sir?
Oh, good, Gavin. Please call me Dick.
I will indeed. Now, Wonderful. Again, so much to cover across an incredible life. You're 77. At this stage of your life, why decide to pen this autobiography?
Oh, well, look, over the years, people have been saying, Dick, have you written your autobiography? And I never have. I had written books on my various flights around the world, and also I'd climbed Ball's Pyramid out near Lord Howe Island. I'd written a book on that, but never my whole autobiography, and that's what's come out this time.
And was it challenging to do that? I mean, you've done so much across so many careers. Daunting?
It was hard. It was hard to fit it in, but I've basically put my whole life there. In fact, I really concentrated on it during the lockdown last year. I was locked down in Sydney here, and so I kept working on the book, and that's basically why I got it finished, and I'm really glad I have. I read it now, and I think, gee, it's amazing I'm still alive.
It is indeed. I love on the book, Paul Hogan describes you as part Bear Grylls, part Bill Gates, but 100% Aussie larrikin. That's quite an amazing description to have.
Yes, Paul gave me a wonderful, and that was the caption we put on the cover, which is just fantastic. He's been a good friend of mine. I've taken him flying in my helicopter up into the mountains, and he's a great bloke.
In reading the biography, you know, some of your schooling, some of your history, you weren't exactly destined to do and achieve the incredible things that you have achieved. Interested in the aviation, first of all, where did that come from? How did you start? Given, you know, once you left school, how did you start in aviation?
Yeah, I never thought I'd be involved in aviation. When I was a young kid, I was absolutely hopeless at school. I came 45th out of 47th class. And so I thought I'd be hopeless. And it was beyond comprehension that I'd ever be able to learn to fly. But after I started Dick Smith Electronics and ran it for a few years and started to do okay, a friend had a flying school. And he said, Dick, you can come out and learn to fly at $25 an hour. And so I thought, oh, that sounds good. So I went out and learned to fly a little Piper Cherokee. And then I was starting to make good money in the business. And I had enough money to buy myself a twin Comanche. And then one day I was stranded at an airfield in bad weather. And a helicopter came in and landed. And I walked over to the pilot and I said, how come you're flying in such bad weather? And he said, oh, in a helicopter, you fly under the cloud. And if it gets too low, you land and have a cup of tea with somebody. And I remember thinking, wow, that's the type of aeroplane I want. So I rang up Bell Helicopters in Brisbane and arranged to have a demo flight. And the rest is history. I managed to buy myself a helicopter and fly it around the world and to the North Pole.
I mean, incredible. Some of those world aviation records, just absolutely incredible. First helicopter to the North Pole, first solo circumnavigation by helicopter, on and on it goes. I was interested in some of the balloon flights, though. You've got a couple of incredible records on balloon flighting. Why ballooning?
Oh, balloon's incredible. I mean, first of all, it's quite risky. Long-distance ballooning is quite risky because you want to take off in zero wind, then you want really high winds to get you across. In this case, I did the first crossing of Australia from the west coast to the east coast, and at one stage, we were doing 160 kilometres an hour ground speed, and here we are in this balloon. But we knew that we'd have to land in less than about 10 kilometres of an hour wind, otherwise we could be injured. And as it was, when we got across Australia, we started descending and we looked down into the Clarence River Valley and there was just no wind. And so by sheer luck, we sped across Australia, I think 47 hours. Then the other balloon flight I did was an unusual one. Normally balloon flights all around the world go from west to east because the prevailing winds are westerlies and a balloon just flies in the wind. But I was going to fly from Australia to New Zealand or attempt it. And my friend John Singleton bet me that I couldn't go from New Zealand to Australia. And I said, John, that's impossible. It's against the wind. But then I checked with the Met Bureau and they said, oh, once or twice a year, if you flew low, you might be able to go the opposite way. And so we ended up with a $100,000 bet that I couldn't go the wrong way. And I managed to do it. It's all covered in the book. It's quite an interesting story.
I was about to reveal from the book for how much Singo put on that bet. So 100K, not bad at all.
No, fantastic. And I won it.
Exactly. Now, you do reflect on this next topic in your book, but what has aviation taught you? What have you gleaned from aviation? What life lessons have you gleaned from flying?
Oh, well, I've certainly, what a fantastic world. I've flown 5 times around the world, and in the book, in the end covers, is the map of my flights around the world. And it's an incredible world. I mean, looking at it from the air, and I came back from my solo flight in the helicopter in 1983, and I'd never heard of climate change, but I mentioned the damage we're doing to the world, because at 500 feet in my helicopter, you hardly flew over any wilderness. You were mainly flying in Northern Hemisphere in smog all the time, and everything was being cleared. And I remember coming back and thinking, God, it's amazing that 6 billion people can do so much damage and it's not affecting us. Of course, then years later, people said, well, it is affecting us. You have to really... And since then, I've been campaigning on trying not to have endless population increase.
Very interested in that. Well, let's dive into that. You're not shy of a public opinion, which is what I'm sure Aussies love you for. You've been outspoken and involved in so many great causes. Population and overpopulation has been a topic for you. Are you still of that mind that we do need to look at that into the future? And has COVID changed the way that you think about that topic?
Well, no, it's certainly in my mind. We need to have a plan. See, every Australian family has a plan about the number of kids they're going to have. They can have 20 children in their lifetime. Nobody does. Parents have the number of kids they can give a good life to. They think about it and discuss it and plan it. But as a country, we have absolutely no plan. Presently, we have about 27 million or so. And the growth rate before the pandemic was about 1.6% a year, which would take us to 100 million people in Australia at the end of this century, when our grandkids will still be alive. Now, not many people think that's a sensible number for an arid country like Australia. So one day we'll have to live in balance. And what I communicate, and I think 8 out of 10 Australians agree with me, is we should have a population plan. If we bought our immigration, we don't have a growth rate problem from births. We're about replacement level from births and death.
Fairly flat, but,
yes. Yeah, but immigration, I'm very pro-immigration, but it's at sensible levels. And our long-term immigration has been about 70,000 a year, which is a sensible number, and that would round off our population about 30 million. Mm. But when, under John Howard, they increased the immigration staggeringly to 240,000 a year.
It's very interesting, Dick Smith, that you raise this, because I've spoken to economists and politicians about this exact immigration topic in recent months, because, of course, we've had zero overseas net migration. So you're saying that we need to, and no one can quite answer or give me an answer about where should we get back to once those borders open. What's your view? Because as you said, it was very, very high, over 200,000 at one point.
Yeah, the developers want to go back to 240,000, 250,000. They want. So you've got to understand there's just ultimate greed. Most of the developers are billionaires and they just want more money. So they have the power with the government to increase the immigration so we can get the growth back so they can double their fortunes yet again. My belief is quite different, and it's agreed by most people, is that eventually you have to live in balance. You can't grow forever. And so someone has to say, what's a sensible number for Australia? Just as every Aussie family says, what's a sensible number of kids to have? And my suggestion is we're pretty well there now. If we brought our immigration back to about 70,000 a year, which is the long-term average, we would end up rounding off below 30 million. And I think that's a sensible number. Any more, I think, is a catastrophe. How's this figure? Every year, even with the pandemic, we're increasing our population in the world by 80 million a year. That's 3 times the number of Australians every year. And the United Nations has no population plan. And if you believe in human-induced climate change, which I do, it's amazing no one's discussing the fact that if we increase the population by 80 million a year, that's going to be really difficult to do something about climate change.
And you don't buy the argument that technology, advances in technology, will enable the world to cope with that extra population, be it agricultural technology, living technology, whatever it is. You don't buy that argument?
Well, it can't go forever. See, there is certainly the people who claim that, look, we're just so ingenious as human beings that we'll always be able to solve the growth problem. But you couldn't end up with a world where there's, say, 1 meter space for every person. That would be trillions, and that would be ridiculous. So even the people who are pushing growth, all when I push them, agree there has to be a limit. And there's no discussion on that limit. No one says it's 10 billion or 11 billion. There's no discussion at all because the developers are so powerful, the wealthy are so powerful, and the greed is so great. They just want during their lifetime eternal growth, compound growth, so they can make more and more money.
Of course, you would recognize the voice speaking here with Dick Smith. His new autobiography has just been released. It's called My Adventurous Life. Now, Dick, you've done so much. You've won so many accolades, Order of Australia Medal, Australian of the Year, on and on it goes. You've never had a tilt at politics. Do you wish you had?
No. I've been in government appointments. I've been the chairman of the Civil Aviation Safety Authority, and I said in my book, that taught me, working in Canberra taught me why the Soviet Union had collapsed, because it is a completely different way to the free enterprise business thing. I wouldn't be a politician. If someone wanted me as dictator, I'd probably accept that for a couple of years.
You'd be happy with that. Well, I was reading in researching our chat that there was some kind of public poll at the time that then Prime Minister Paul Keating had flagged the Republic, or the referendum was on. You were sort of favourite to be Australia's first president.
You're absolutely right. And believe it or not, I'm not really a Republican. Because I came up through the Boy Scouts where we were saluting the flag and honouring the Queen and all the rest of it, I'm not against a Republic. I'd support a Republic if it was a simple replacement of the Queen with an Australian. But most people want to have a Republic with a president who's voted in. And I can just see we might end up with someone like Donald Trump.
That's
and
right.
I don't know if that's the best thing in the world. So to me, I'm a lukewarm Republican. I presume it will happen one day, but I'm not sort of pushing for it.
Well, as I said at the start, Dick Smith, so much that we could talk about, but I do know you have to run. An absolute pleasure. Can we expect to see you here in the beautiful tropical north at some point soon when those borders open?
Of course, yes. I should have been there a few weeks ago, but I'm currently driving around Australia doing the Grey Nomad bit with my wife Pip.
Right.
And we started off in Sydney in about April and drove down to Melbourne and then across to Adelaide, then to Perth. And then in June we drove Perth to Darwin, absolutely fantastic. And then we were planning in July, August to come down into Queensland, across the Gulf and into Cairns, and we love Cairns, and then down the coast. But of course, we've been locked up since then. I don't think I can get into your state yet, so it'll be a delay yet, but we'll certainly be driving down the Pacific Highway, which will be fantastic.
Beautiful. All right. We'll have to get you in studio if you do have any time on your Grey Nomad adventures. Dick Smith, My Adventurous Life, the autobiography, it is out now. It's an incredible read, absolutely fascinating, remarkable life, absolutely brilliant that you can share it with us all. Dick Smith, thank you for the time on The King Review today.
Wonderful to talk to you. Thanks very much.